based on the acclaimed documentary Shooting the Darkness, which was shown on RTE earlier this year. A new book presents the stories of seven photographers whose images captured the most important events of the Northern Irish Trouble. They talk about the photographs they took, how they got the shot, what it cost them to take the photograph, and reflect on whether it was worth it. With me in studio, two of those photographers, Alan Lewis and Crispin Rodwell, and the producer of the documentary, Thomas Kelly, who I presume was also very instrumental in the publication of the book, which is also called Shooting the Darkness. It was the reaction in some ways to the documentary, I think, Thomas, that sent you off, and well, you didn't read that made that sent the book into publication.
Sean, after the documentary aired, Blackstaff Press in Belfast got in touch with us, and we'd been thinking that perhaps it would make a good book, but they got in touch with us. They had done other work around the Troubles, such as reporting the Troubles. Ivan Little and Derek Henderson's book kind of touched on a lot of the same themes. And so, yeah, that kind of got the conversation going. Then we spoke to all of the photographers who had been involved in the documentary to see if they were interested in kind of carrying the project forward, and they were. So
yeah, and I think one of the great things about the book is because these are photographs, they are still images. I mean, no matter how often you see them on the screen, and when we saw them in the documentary, which was the documentary was a great piece of television, but you don't have the time to look at the photographs that perhaps you have when you have the book in front of you, when you can actually open it, look at it, read about it, look at it again, and actually really take in the image in front of you. The book allows you to do that.
Oh, absolutely. And indeed, that's one of the things like Hugh Russell mentions in the documentary, that how when you have the image in front of you in print, it's more impactful. You can't look away. You can't scroll up from it. You can't change the channel. It really does kind of sear itself into your memory.
Yeah, and also the director of the documentary doesn't need to say, "Well, I've got 54 minutes of television. I better get a move on. Yeah, I can't delay on this particular still." But let's talk to both Alan and Lewis about that moment. Maybe Alan, first of all, when you capture something, because I don't know who it is that mentions in the documentary, but this idea, I think it's Tom Lawlor actually of the Irish Times, talks about this idea that there's mayhem quite often happening all around you, and yet you're looking for the split second that will actually capture that. You know, could be 3 hours of mayhem, a split second that actually defines it and tells the whole story.
Yeah, I think Tom actually referred to it as distilling the moment. It's something that you practice, you train, and you're actually taking the photograph becomes second nature. It's automatic, and you're actually looking like a director probably at a scene as it emerges in front of you, and you're trying to pick key moments out.
But are you there with your camera up at your eye, rather than, there's no point in you having the camera down, I suppose, and looking around at what's happening.
No, you're looking through the lens most of the time, through at what's happening in front of you, or your camera's close up to your face and you're looking over the top of it.
Is there some image off camera that I'm missing?
At times, because if you're covering, for example, a riot, the focal point of a riot can change in a flash, really. You know, you could be at the point of a triangle photographing army or police at one side and rioters at the other, and the next thing, police move and you're behind them and the rocks and bricks are coming over on top of you.
I guess, though, Crispin, part of the camera then, what it presents you with, it kind of separates you from what you're looking at, because in some cases what you're looking at is, you know, they are terrible events unfolding in front of you, dangerous events, in fact. Does the camera kind of, is it like, you know, when you're driving along in your car and there's all sorts of things maybe happening around you on the road, but you're in this little bubble of where you think you're almost untouchable. Does the camera give you a kind of an armour, perhaps, in that situation?
I never felt particularly strengthened
or safe
because I had a camera. Certainly, seldom did we feel very, very threatened. It did happen at times, but I think the press got off fairly lightly in terms of casualties. But I think there was an acceptance on all sides that, that we were there doing a job, that, that we weren't combatants, that, that we weren't there to to make anything happen.
Yeah, you were simply recording what was happening in front of your eyes. I mean, I want to talk about specifically some of the photographs that are in the book. And the first one that I want to talk about is one that I've simply called Baby on page 48 of the book. You might, this was a very important day, I think, for you, Alan.
Yes.
You might remind us what exactly had happened on this particular day. I'll just get the exact date now. You probably remember the date, in fact, do you?
It's December 71.
Yeah. It was, December the 11th. Yeah.
Yeah. There'd been an explosion at a furnishing company on the Shankill Road. And there'd been two babies killed along with two adults and a lot of people injured. But I'd arrived up well after the actual explosion. I'd been off duty that day, but sort of presented myself and went up. And they were still digging through in the rubble. And I'd only just started out of university, and I hadn't seen anything, you know, anything that would have shocked me before.
So you were quite young then at this time.
Yeah, I would have been 19 then.
Yeah.
So it was a question of placing yourself beside an ambulance, staying out of the road of the first responders who were doing the job of trying to get people injured away. And they brought a baby out of the rubble, and I just had the finger on the shutter release and couldn't actually take a picture of what I was looking at. It was just horrific.
This particular baby was dead. Was it clear to you that the baby was dead?
It was just it was like something out of a horror film.
Yeah.
The baby wasn't covered, and the ambulance man just brought the baby towards me, passed me and into the ambulance.
But something stopped you from taking that particular shot?
I just couldn't tell. It was just, I froze. I just was so horrified at what was coming at me in my lens.
Later on, though, then, a second first responder comes out.
It was actually the same ambulance man. It was about maybe 20 or so minutes later. This time he was carrying another baby, and it was wrapped up in a blanket. And in the interim period of time, I'd sort of resolved to myself, if I was going to make a career here, I would have to sort of start taking pictures and forget, you know, what I was saying, and just actually take the picture and then, you know, deal with it afterwards.
Yeah, so, and it's one of the things that really strikes me about the image is the fact that, yes, it's horrific. Obviously, the baby, again, we can presume that this baby, unfortunately, was killed in the event as well. But it's the care with which the ambulance man holds the baby. There's some comfort in that. And did the parents get to see this? Do you know?
I honestly don't know. I mean, they would have seen the photograph, certainly, because it's in the, you know, in the years afterwards, it was turned into a mural.
Yeah. In fact, you thought that this photograph, when people see a baby carried out of a situation like this, they'll say, this has to end. It had quite the opposite effect.
It had. I sort of told myself that maybe if somebody sees this, it'll turn them away from violence, possibly, because that's the way I would have thought. But apparently, I was talking to David Irvine from the Progressive Unionist Party, aligned to the UVF, and he said it had the opposite effect. But he did sort of... he did say to me that that picture actually did bring people like him into the peace process.
Yeah.
So maybe 30 years later,
it
would have had a positive effect, but it didn't have the effect at the time.
Took time.
No.
I might be making presumptions here, but when Alan talks about being 19 back at that point, I think you might have come into photography a little bit later on, Crispin. Am I right in thinking that?
You are. When Alan took that picture, it was the day after my 10th birthday.
Right.
And then 22 years later, also on the Shankill Road, only 300 or 400 metres from where Alan had done the pictures, in very, very similar circumstances. Saturday afternoon, very, very busy, lots of shoppers around. Nine people in a fishmonger's in Frizzell's fish shop were killed. Three of them were children. They were killed when a bomb was carried in and placed on the counter. It exploded prematurely and killed the IRA man who was delivering the bomb.
I'm looking at two particular photographs from that, a number that you took on that day, of the funeral cortege. Three hearses in this particular case stopped directly outside the place where the bomb had spoken. There's another point in the documentary and in the book where people talk about the silence when something happens. In fact, I think it was about Bloody Sunday, this moment of silence around the body of Jack Duddy is spoken about. Was there a side that this to me looks like a very silent moment? Is there a kind of an atmosphere around these photographs that perhaps gives you the moment to hit the you know, to open the shutter?
There's great reverence there. In the picture, you can see a couple of hundred people lining both sides of the Shankill Road, and as you say, three hearses side by side stopped right beside where it had happened. In the hearses were Evelyn Baird, her partner Michael Morrison, and their 7-year-old daughter Michelle.
Very important for you, I think, because it's here in the book, it's there in the documentary, and now you've done it again tonight. Saying those names, I think, is that important for you?
It is, and I think in our small way, I hope that working on the documentary and the book has it's a memorial to the people whose deaths and bereavement we've recorded in the book. It is important.
There's another moment where we hear about what's called a collect. Maybe explain to us what a collect is, first of all, Alan.
When someone has been killed or seriously injured in an explosion or a shooting, we would have, all the photographers would have had to go to the house of the bereaved family and ask if we could borrow a photograph of the deceased. And it was the single most difficult part of the job because, you know, you were actually intruding on people's personal grief. You knew you were doing it. You didn't like doing it, but... Yeah. It was a necessary evil as far as we were concerned.
And you had an awful collect situation where you were sent to the house of a young woman you knew.
Yeah, there was a girl called Irene Andrews who was with a nationalist senator, Paddy Wilson, who was a big friend of Jerry Fitz, one of the founders of the SDLP. And Paddy and Irene were both murdered by loyalist paramilitaries, and the names eventually emerged on the morning after the bodies were discovered. I went to the house of the mother of Irene, knowing that Irene was a personal friend of mine, and thought it maybe be easier if I was able to sort of put a personal face to asking for the collect. But when I got to the door, she just said, "Oh, Irene's not here yet. Alan, come on in, have a cup of tea."
She didn't know
anything. She didn't know. And I just felt like I wanted the ground to open up underneath me. And I had tried to make desperate excuses to get out of the house. And she was asking me, was it about her Irish dancing? And I just wanted out of there. And eventually I did manage to talk my way out of the house. And I said I would get in touch with her again, but then I rang the police and told them that the woman didn't know
to get a
minister or a priest or somebody up to actually be with her and let her know what has happened. That was several hours after the media became aware of the name.
Incredibly difficult stuff. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the material that is in the book is totally on stage, but I think several people point out at different points that the Republican side of the conflict here were much better at being sure that the images were caught. I think the very first photograph you took, your first photograph as a freelancer, in fact, Crispin, it has to have been staged. You didn't catch this by accident. And this is the one, what I'm calling the tongue delivery.
The picture shows three pill-sized pellets on the tongue of a prisoner's mother. And what the pellets are communications coming out of the Mays prison right at the start of the 1981 hunger strike. And my father was a journalist, and he received in the post one sheet of prison-issued toilet paper with microscopic writing over one side of it. This was then rolled into a tiny little pellet wrapped in cling film, and the prisoners and their visitors would exchange them when they kissed each other goodbye. So my father, being the inquisitive type, contacted the number that was on the sheet of paper, which was this prisoner's mother, and we went along to talk to her, and she was happy posing with three as yet undelivered letters on her tongue.
Yeah, and then we see on the other side of the page one of, well, maybe not one of those three, but a letter actually opened out. That's, and the writing is tiny. It has to be said. What are you hoping this book will achieve, just as we round up?
Well, I think there are a lot of the stories, like you mentioned before, kind of you only have an hour of television to tell certain stories. Mm. And all of the photographers, like over the periods that we spoke to them, had so much to talk about, so many incredible pictures. And this, I suppose, gives kind of breathing space to them and lets kind of expands on the documentary.
I asked you before we came to air, Crispin, about the little boy jumping in front of the Time for Peace on the wall, and that wasn't staged. It's such a spontaneous shot. But I want to finish by going to Alan, if you don't mind. And the shot you have of Louis Johnson at the funeral of his father in 1997, little boy, 7-year-old, like grief stricken, and it's just he's caught in between the arms of two of the pallbearers, and you see how painful it is from watching his father be buried. There's a beautiful end to this.
Well, when I took that picture, the little boy was just so grief stricken. It sort of had a lasting impact on me, and for years, I always wondered what had happened to him. And he was invited along to the book launch in Belfast, and I got to meet him and talk to him about his dad and talk to him about the picture, and it was just closure for me, really.
What did the picture mean for him?
He actually didn't want to discuss what the picture meant for him, but he was happy to be there and sort of lend his support to the book. It's always very, very difficult when you're dealing with people who have sort of been bereaved.
Don't want to be prurient about it.
No, but the nice ending to it for me was that he'd got his university degree, he'd got a good job, and his wife was with him, and she was 4 months from giving birth. Ah. So it was a happy ending for me. You know, okay. I was just delighted to see that.
And when was that launch?
It was about 3 weeks ago in Belfast.
Right, so she's 3 and a bit months now.
Yeah,
so
3 and a bit months.
Best of luck to the both of them, and hopefully that will all go well for them. Thomas Kelly, producer there, Crispin Rodwell and Alan Lewis, photographers, speaking to me about the book Shooting the Darkness, published by Blackstaff Press. And by the way, you can watch the documentary of the same name. It's still available on the RTE player.